I've got the thumbs up. We're a green light, friends, green light. Super glad that you're here with us this morning and adventuring in this with all of us as we shift, and we're not allowed to have congregational singing. We've had to scale our band back by quite a bit, but we can be together, and that is a sweetness. And so thank you for being brave and coming, even though our gathering continues to look a little bit different. We do have church every Sunday. We get to, and that's a celebration. And so 10 o'clock every Sunday morning, we will be together here in this space. We continue to live stream. We apologize for those of you that were online last week and you experienced our hiccup. We had a power outage, and it just messed with the router next door, and we had all sorts of issues. But we're live. We're with you this morning, and we're just really happy to see those of you that are at home. We always love it when you shoot us texts or emails and say we're listening. When you fill out that online communication card, it really is a sweetness. We miss all of you. We miss having this space full, but whatever. Okay, move on. This month, through the end of December, I guess we'll deliver the first week of January, but we are continuing to do our gift card drive to help with Vision House and the Nourishing Network. And so we are wondering, as you are buying Christmas gifts, if you would be willing to pick up maybe a $25, a $10, a $5 card, gift card, and you can mail those to the church address, and you can find that address on the website. If you go to brookviewchurch.com and scroll to the bottom, there's a little footer at the bottom of every screen that has our address. But also, there's a crack under the door over here. And so anytime during the week, you can go to the side of the building and slide those underneath the door. And we would love to be able to collect those. I know that we have given upwards of almost $1,000 every year between those two organizations. And this year, like all of you are fully aware, the needs are high. And so if we can have them count on us for that blessing again, I know that it would be a huge, huge gift to them, as a lot of their donor base has had to shift as they're losing work and all sorts of things. So if you're able and you want to bless somebody and you're looking for a way to do that, those gift cards to Target, to gas stations, to, I mean, even a restaurant where they could order some takeout food would be a huge blessing. So again, mail those to the church mailbox or slide them under the door here during the week, and we will grab those and make sure that those get delivered. That's all that I have for announcements. I do want to tell you that we are meeting with kids still. The village is actually considered childcare and children's programming, and so the governor's mandate, new orders, did not affect any of that or the way that we do that. We still have openings at the village. So if you're a family at home that is struggling right now and you're realizing, oh, I thought we were going to go back to school and I was thinking I could hunker down for the next couple of months, but that's not looking real reasonable, we would love to have your kids. There are such cool things going on next door during the week. Trevor's doing a fantastic job with students, and they are enjoying being able to be together. And on Fridays, we get to be in this space for our elementary aged kids, and we get to do kids church together. And it is so fun for me. I love that you're sharing your kids with me. Bring as many as you want to. We are having a blast in here. So that programming is happening. We will not be meeting this Friday. The village is closed on Thursday and Friday this week to celebrate the holiday. And then we will follow the regular school schedule calendar, and we'll be closed at Christmas time as well. So that's it. And yeah.
Thank you. Well, Jen and Matt, right at the end of the opening time of worship there, Tony said, that was awesome. So I just want you to know, yeah. Whether we're pivoting or pirouetting or whatever we're doing through this season, way to go, guys. I also want to say this has been a very contemplative, low kind of simmery, reflective kind of thing. But I don't need that for the message. I need energy. So, Bob, give me a whoop or something. Yeah, let's go. All right, you guys. William Faulkner, an American novelist from the 20th century, once said, "It's hard believing, but disaster seems to be good for people." And now, he said it in 1955 to a crowd in Tokyo, Japan, at a literary event where he was asked to explain the unprecedented wave of creative output of Japanese literature and poetry following the bombings of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. To apply that kind of thought to our time and our season, we have kind of been asking all fall, are there ways in which COVID-19 plus all the other challenges might actually be good for us? Are there ways in which all that's happening right now might serve to deepen us as apprentices of Jesus that are learning to live into his way? But there is a major difference between previous generations and our generation in how we're responding to disaster. Have you noticed? In the past, as a general rule, and I know that this is a bit of an oversimplification, but in past times of crisis, the impulse of our nation was to turn to God. Whether it was World War II or the Great Depression or the Spanish flu. But the last time I saw even a glimmer of this, and I remember it clearly, was right after 9/11. You guys remember that? So those of you that are old enough, like, you don't have to be that old, but... You guys, what happened after 9/11? What happened to church attendance? Skyrocketed. I mean, it went way up, and prayer vigils were held. And what happened is, as a nation, we just sort of reflexively turned to God. But even then, that only lasted a couple of weeks, and then it kind of died down. But even in 2001, you felt it. In 2020, and you can do your own research, but there has been no return, like on a national level, to prayer or repentance or even any kind of appeal to God. Now, you go, well, obviously church attendance is down with all the mandates. Yes, but as a nation, we are not in this time really turning back to God. The New York Times recently put out an article called, "God is Dead, So is the Office. These People Want to Save Both." And it's about an attempt to revive spirituality inside of corporate America. It's the vision of a group of Harvard Divinity School graduates. And they are Unitarian Universalists. If you don't know what that means, it means they want to be spiritual, but they don't want to belong to any religion in particular. So these Harvard grads work as what they call divinity consultants. And what they do is they bring a feeling of spirituality to secular offices all throughout the nation. So these days, as you know, many people are working remotely from home, where there is little to no boundary between work and the rest of life, right? And because secular workplaces offer no spiritual meaning, these divinity consultants, okay, grad students from Harvard Divinity School, offer religious type rituals designed for digital workers. How about that? So the idea is to feel a bit of spirituality then in your everyday work. So here are a few of the spiritual rituals. This is what this is. I'm not making this up. There is a ritual for purchasing your domain name. There's a ritual for when your corporation registers as an LLC. There is a grieving ritual for when your project does not have success. Well, you guys, it's a fascinating article. One of the consultants explained, regardless of what you and I might think about it, the fact is that people are showing up in the workplace with these big deficits in themselves when it comes to belonging and connection to the beyond. Well, yeah. Another one added, the question we ask is, how do you translate the ancient traditions that have given people access to meaning-making practices, but in a context that is not centered around the congregation? And this all flows out of a recognition by these Harvard Divinity students that people are experiencing emptiness, that the human ache for meaning is buried deep inside us all. Now, I'm convinced that this is because we are all made in the image of God. But it's becoming less and less common for people in our nation to attempt to quench that ache by looking to God in general and to Jesus in particular. And all of this is just a more recent iteration of a trend that's been developing for centuries in Western culture and the U.S. And what we're seeing is a shift from a Christian to a post-Christian culture. So sometimes sociologists divide Western history into three basic stages. The first is what might be called pre-Christian culture. So this is like Celtic Ireland before Christianity came to it. This is like the Norse tribes and the Vikings before the gospel. It is a culture of gods and goddesses. It's tribal, it's violent, it's charged with spiritual energy. So it's like the opposite of what we would consider to be a secular culture. But as Christianity began to spread further and further west all through Europe, the West moved into a second phase of what's sometimes referred to as a Christianized culture. Now, I don't like, sometimes people call it a Christian culture. I don't, because it was never a Christian culture. But it was a Christianized culture. Even in its most pure state, it was always a hybrid. And it was always Christian ideas sort of mixed in with other stuff. But you begin to see a strong influence of Christian thinking on the West, Europe and the United States and so forth. So this would be like Victorian culture at the turn of the century, or this would be the United States right after the Second Great Awakening. But Christian values were kind of the framework or the framing of the building of society. Like so much of society sort of hung on that framework. For the most part, Christian ideas were embraced and they were reinforced. For example, when I was growing up playing Little League, after our normal Little League season, we would play in all-star tournaments, which was like the apex of my existence as a 12-year-old. Because if you keep winning these tournaments, you actually can play for a world title. Many of you know, like, you know about this because you've seen it on ESPN or whatever, right? So the U.S. champ will play Korea or Japan or the Dominican Republic, and it's like it's on national TV. Like this was my dream as a 12-year-old. But once we started playing in those tournaments, we got outside of the regular Little League season. There's all this pregame hype. There's an announcer that calls your name when you run out on the field. There's the national anthem. It's like a kid's dream. Like for me, it was just like this. This is heaven. But in my childhood, at many of those Little League tournaments, the announcer would do something else besides, you know, name all the players on each team and do the national anthem and all that. The players he would read something called the Little League Pledge. And all the players were then invited to recite the words along with him together. Let me read for you guys the Little League Pledge. You ready? This is going to change your life. Here it is. I trust in God, I love my country, and I will respect its laws. I will play fair and strive to win, but win or lose, I will always do my best. Think about that first line. I trust in God, I love my country. Okay, this Little League Pledge was written in the 1950s, but even as a kid in the 1980s, in the very progressive part of the country, in the Pacific Northwest, we still recited this. You guys, this is a Christianized culture, and we're not there anymore. As far as I know, except for maybe some really like rural areas in the backwoods of our country, no Little Leagues still have their kids recite this pledge. Why? Because there is no way that the people in our culture would stand for this. And that's because we have shifted into a third phase, which we would call post-Christian culture. Now, this shift started hundreds of years ago with the Enlightenment, And at first, it was mostly held by intellectual elites. But over the years, it has taken root in our mainstream culture. And here's the thing to notice about post-Christian culture. It is absolutely not a return to pre-Christian culture. Like, nobody that I'm aware of has gone back to worshiping Odin, right? Like, we make really cool movies about him, but that's about it. As far as I know, nobody is sacrificing their firstborn son to the spirits of Briar Park. I hope, right? Post-Christian culture is not a return to pre-Christian culture. It is a reaction against Christian culture, or at least against Christianized culture. It's an attempt to retain parts of it and yet somehow move beyond it. It's sort of like, here's what I think it's like. It's sort of like Western culture is having a rebellious teenage moment. We're like the adolescent who's texting how lame their parents are while we're still living in their house eating all their food. Right, we're mad at them while they're still, like, they're paying for our college and everything. This is kind of what's happening with Western culture. Our culture is enjoying the benefits that are left over from Christianity while at the same time complaining about it and rebelling against it. This is particularly true when it comes to something like human rights. I mean, think about how committed we are to human rights in our culture. We protect the rights of the weak and the powerless. We protect the rights of the unusual. We want to empower and value every single kind of person. And you guys, that's a really, really good thing. But where does that vision in our society even come from? Yuval Harari is one of the leading atheists of our generation, and he calls human rights a Christian myth. Because there is no coherent argument from Darwinian materialism for human rights. You cannot get from survival of the fittest to we should all inconvenience ourselves to care for those on the margins. Like, that is beyond logically inconsistent. The idea that each human life has enormous meaning and value, it comes from the idea that we are all made in the image of God. And sociologists and historians recognize this. Not just the Christian ones, you guys. Like, all of them. Even the atheists see the connection. Yet our culture is having this rebellious teenager moment against Christianity. So post-Christianity is nothing like pre-Christianity. Post-Christianity lives at home with its Christian parents and then complains about them while eating all their food. See, post-Christianity still yearns for all the justice and all the love of the kingdom, but it rejects God and Jesus as any kind of authority on the matter. And so you might think of it like this. Post-Christianity is an attempt to experience the kingdom while at the same time discarding the king. Post-Christian culture is still, like, highly moral, is it not? In fact, it's painfully moral at times, and we feel this. Like, there's powerful advocacy for human rights and equality, which has become even louder in these past few months. And the fact that we care about this is, like, really, it's really, really a good thing. But notice how that comes with other stuff. It comes with a rise of what we call cancel culture. Right, like this online shaming with the internet mob as judge, jury, and executioner. Our culture inherited from Christianity very high moral standards, but is now attempting to live them without the power of Christ. So we lack the necessary resources to live into our own culture's vision. And the result is a culture incapable of living up to its own standards. I mean, why is there so much anger and frustration right now? Well, partly it's because we want to live in this, like, secular utopia without God, and the big fat problem is it's not working. And as our culture becomes more and more post-Christian, the church feels it. Followers of Jesus feel it. Like, over the last 50 years or so, we find ourselves in a very different place in our society. Let me just quickly highlight three shifts that have happened over the last 50 years. Three shifts for the church. First, the church has shifted from the majority to the minority. Now, like, we're not an ethnic minority, but more of like a cognitive minority. Our worldview, our values, our practices, and social norms are more and more at sharp odds with the broader culture. And so, we face enormous pressure to just assimilate to the herd. We find ourselves more and more on the fringe of society. While the church was once at the center, we are definitely now on the margins. Okay, second shift. We have moved from a place of honor to a place of shame. You feel that? Like, there was a day in which the church or believers really did hold a place of honor in society. You guys, that day is gone. Christians were once thought of as intelligent and kind and generally good for society. But these days, those words are rarely associated with Christianity. And that leads to a third shift that I think many of us feel deep in our bones. And that's from widespread tolerance to rising hostility. Now, we're not facing the kind of hostilities that other Jesus followers have in other places and other generations. I mean, for them, it's been much, much worse. So we don't want to get too whiny about it. But there is a rising opposition toward Christians. More and more people think of us not as just like we're different. Like, what? You don't sleep together before? Like, how do you even know if you're compatible, man? Okay, we used to be thought of as like, you know, weird, but harmless. But today, more and more people are actually thinking of Christians as dangerous, the problem, the main problem in society, as standing in opposition to what's actually good for society. There's a rising trend of hostility, and you guys, we can feel this. But this is nothing new for followers of Jesus. It may be new for us, but this is not new at all for the way of Jesus. In fact, historians now argue that these shifts in our culture put Western civilization closer to the culture of the New Testament than it has been for 1,000 years. And the metaphor scripture writers use to name the felt experience of our time is exile, living in exile. Author Lee Beach describes exile in this way: the experience of knowing that one is an alien and perhaps even in a hostile environment where the dominant values run counter to one's own. This sense of exile is experienced by anyone who feels alienated, cast adrift, or marginalized by their inability or unwillingness to conform to the tyranny of majority opinion. More and more, this is what following Jesus feels like in our culture. I kind of like the simple way that Eugene Peterson defines exile. He defines it this way. He says, the essential meaning of exile is that we are where we do not want to be. We are separated from home. And not only are we, as apprentices of Jesus, experiencing like this cultural exile, but if exile is most simply being where we don't want to be, even more simply, just being separated from what feels like home, some of you guys are facing a deeply personal exile as well. Like something has gone sideways in your life, and you are not where you want to be. You feel far from home. Could be that a marriage fell apart, and your life has just been turned upside down. Could be that your health has failed or is failing and life is not what you want it to be. It could be that life has taken you into a geographic region that's just not home for you. Nothing feels familiar. It feels strange. It all feels foreign. It could be that your parents have divorced and there's not even a home for you to go to anymore. Maybe you're single and you really don't want to be. It's not how you want life to be. Maybe more than anything, you just want a child and to begin building a family. But it isn't happening and you feel separated from home. Right now, we're facing a level of exile that I think many of us have never imagined. There is this dislocation and disequilibrium in our bodies and in our souls. And we feel it moment by moment, day after day. And it comes from the loss of safety and security and familiarity. It's the loss of what we would simply call home. Nothing feels like home. But while exile may feel new to many of us, this experience is not new at all for the people of God. It goes way, way back even before the time of Jesus. And there is an incredible passage in the Old Testament that gives us insight into how to not only survive, but like how to thrive in exile, in a time of exile. Now, this comes from the book of Jeremiah, and before I read this, I want to give you a little bit of background. For centuries, God had warned Israel through the prophets, which is basically like the second half of the entire Old Testament. He'd warned them to turn away from idolatry and immorality and injustice, but as a culture, the nation refused time and time again until finally, after the heart of the nation became almost completely closed off to God and his voice and his love, Israel was then left by God to their own devices. And most of the time, that's God's judgment in Scripture. He's not like, okay, let me kill you. It's just more of a, okay, now you're on your own. Like, if you don't want me involved, then I'll respect your freedom, but now you will have to do life without me. And without God's presence and protection, Babylon, the empire from the east, sweeps in and conquers Jerusalem. And what happens is the city is destroyed, the temple is torn down stone by stone, hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children are killed. And as for what's left of the people, most are dragged away to live in exile. They are relocated 700 miles to the east where they have never been, where they live as in the testament, in the language of the Old Testament, as strangers in a strange land. They are a minority. They are on the margins. They are far from home. All around them is a new language, a strange culture, a strange climate, strange religion, strange economic model, strange political system. It's all strange to them. But the prophet of the time, Jeremiah, who is still back home in Jerusalem with a tiny group of people, writes a letter to the exiles in Babylon. And his letter over the centuries becomes kind of a template for how the people of God are to flourish and thrive in exile. So I want to read this together with all of this in mind. This is Jeremiah chapter 29. It says, this is the text of the letter that the prophet Jeremiah sent from Jerusalem to the surviving elders among the exiles and to the priests, the prophets, and all the other people Nebuchadnezzar had carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. It said, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. And here's the message. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there. Do not decrease. Also, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Note the tone of graciousness toward the city of Babylon where these people now find themselves. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. God's like, it makes sense. Look, if the city does well, it'll be good for you. Yes, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Do not let the prophets and diviners among you deceive you. Do not listen to their dreams, to the dreams you encourage them to have. They are prophesying lies to you in my name. I have not sent them, declares the Lord. And this is referring, if you read Jeremiah, to a group of prophets who were saying, hey, you don't have to get used to this place. Don't make this place home. We're going back to Jerusalem any day now. God's going to rescue us and everything's going to go back to normal. So don't settle into this place and make it home. These false prophets were peddling a kind of nostalgia for the past rather than helping people to face reality. Jeremiah continues. This is what the Lord says. When 70 years are completed for Babylon, okay, you're going to be in this place for a long, long time. Several generations, in fact. I will come to you and fulfill my good promise to bring you back to this place. Okay, back home to Jerusalem. And here comes one of the most quoted verses in the entire Old Testament. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future. Then, okay, after 70 years in Babylon, several generations later, you will call on me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. Okay, so not as a religious duty or a little spirituality to kind of dress up your life. God says, when you like really seek me and long for me, I will be found by you, declares the Lord, and will bring you back from captivity. I will gather you from all the nations and places where I have banished you, declares the Lord. So this is not just for those in Babylon. This is for exiles in times and places everywhere. It says, and I will bring you back home to the place from which I carried you into exile. Now, you guys, there is so much that we can take from Jeremiah's letter in how to posture ourselves to flourish and to thrive in a cultural or even a personal exile. And as a general rule, really, there are two extremes that we want to avoid in our posture toward a cultural kind of exile. Okay, the first is separatism. This is where we just kind of disengage with the culture. This is where we just, right, we form a little holy huddle and we hide away from the big bad world around us. Jeremiah says, don't do that. So we don't engage in things like social justice. We don't engage in our community much at all. We want to gather with people who think like us, and to hell with everybody else. Now, we've all seen examples of this, right? Of the church and Christians doing this. But to be honest, I actually don't think that most of us are drawn to this extreme. Instead, there's a second extreme, what we would call syncretism. And this is where what happens is we just get sucked into the gravitational pull of the majority culture. And we just assimilate to its values and its ways. Now, it is not an outright rejection of God. It's not like atheism. But it is a bending of values slowly toward whatever the culture says matters. It's letting go more and more of the way of Jesus in favor of the dominant culture. And when we're in exile, we tend to feel fear and despair. And those emotions can then drive us to one of those two extremes, either one of them. Some go the way of separatism, and you see Christians do this sometimes. Others, many, go the way of syncretism. But in this letter of Jeremiah, what we see, what he is proposing, is a third way. Jeremiah paints a picture of a totally different way to deal with exile. And in this letter, there are seven instructions that are intended to help us cope with life in exile. And you guys, I find these to be incredibly relevant to our current cultural moment. So let me run through these real quick and just see if you can get a picture in your mind of the third way, a vision for how to flourish in a cultural or personal exile. The first thing God says through Jeremiah is this: build houses and settle down, plant gardens and eat what they produce. Meaning, this may not be where you want to be, but this is where you are. Make it home. Fashion the best environment for living out of it that you possibly can. Settle in for the long run. This will take a while, most likely. Embrace the parts of the culture that you can. Like, when you can and it's not in contradiction, eat its food. I mean, they got killer curry in Babylon, baby. Like, enjoy it. Make plans for the long haul and find joy in the place that you find yourself. Number two, marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives and husbands for your children so that they too may have children. Don't stop living life. Make a great profile on eHarmony.com. Live in a thick web of relational life and multi-generational family. Forge thick ties to one another across generational lines. That leads to number three. Increase in number there. Do not decrease. It's pretty self-explanatory. But another way of thinking of that is, don't be afraid of life in this new strange place. Like, carry on. Keep living. Keep going. Keep moving forward. Number four, seek the peace and prosperity of the city. Like, take your work seriously. When you show up for your job, like, take it seriously. Whether you're a teacher, or you make airplanes, or you practice law, or you create new technologies, or you help people buy and sell houses, or you provide lending for people, whatever you do, do that thing with all your heart. Think of it as an act of worship and love. Do all you can to make your city more like the kingdom of heaven, more in line with God's vision for human flourishing. Like, be a good citizen. Pay your taxes. Support the local economy. Share with the poor. Stand up for justice. Vote. Volunteer. Coach Little League whenever they open that thing up. Serve at the Nourishing Network any chance you get. 5. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. Like, above all, pray for God to bless your city. And note the grace and the love here. There's no hostility. There's no rant on Twitter about the city. There's no forming of a subculture with armed guards and walls. No, instead, pray for your city. Ask God to pour his blessing out on it. Pray for your city to prosper under God. Pray for your city to soften under God and to begin to respond to him. Pray for justice and goodness and charity in your city. Don't hate your city. Love it. Serve it. 6, do not be deceived by false prophets. And this is the one "do not" in all of Jeremiah's letter. He says, do not listen to the wrong voices, whatever you do. Don't listen to the wrong voices. Don't be deceived. Be cautious of those who want a kingdom without the king. Watch out for those who would lead you away from the way of Jesus, away from him and his vision for human flourishing. And pay close attention, because sometimes the wolves come dressed as sheep. Not everything that claims the way of Jesus is. Beware. The wolves can destroy you one podcast at a time. Final command. 7. Seek God with all your heart. Even in Babylon, God can be found, Jeremiah is saying. Your life is not what you want it to be. That doesn't mean God isn't there. Guys, God is here, and God is at work right where we live. If you're in exile, he's with you. No matter how away from home you might feel, God is not absent. He's with you, and he's working. So Jeremiah says, seek him with everything that you've got. Read scripture. Go to church, pray like crazy, find other apprentices of Jesus, do life with them, even if it's on Zoom. Organize your life around practices that connect you to God. Do it day after day, month after month, year after year. And see, these 7 commands are actually like a third way. And this third way is not separatism or syncretism. It's kind of like a counterculture that engages the dominant culture. It refuses to separate from the culture or assimilate to it, and instead, it seeks to bring beauty, and life to it whenever possible. And so, if you find yourself in some kind of exile right now, like, what should you do? Well, our example should always be Jesus, who, if you really think about it, spent his entire life in exile. That was an exercise in living in exile. He refused to separate himself from evil and brokenness, and yet he also refused to assimilate to its ways. This is Jesus. This is the one we follow. And so the question, real question for today is, whatever exile we might be facing, will we join Jesus in his way of walking through it? His invitation is to find a way to flourish and thrive, even if we're not where we want to be. Now, some of you are like, you're facing your own unique exile right now. You are absolutely not where you want to be. You are far from home. And while this season has served to throw all of us off kilter, and while all of us are watching our culture do crazy things and react in crazy ways, some of you are facing something more. You're facing like a deep personal exile. And I just want to close by speaking to those of you that are in that place as tenderly as I can. To walk through exile in the way of Jesus, it takes strength and courage. The cool thing is, God can fill you with that if you will continually look to Him. The cool thing is, you are not alone, and I am not alone. Even in exile, God is with you, and He's working. And He's not asking you to just, like, grind it out, to grow bitter and angry, but through gritted teeth, like, somehow stay faithful. It's an invitation to find a way to flourish and to thrive right where you are, even if it's not where you want to be. Jeremiah 29, there's no hostility. There's no fear. There's no anger. No aggression. This is an approach of love and peace. Eugene Peterson wrote a book called Run with the Horses on Jeremiah and the people of God in exile. And he writes this. I think this is awesome. He says, the only place you have to be human is where you are right now. The only opportunity you will ever have to live by faith is the circumstance you are provided this very day. This house you live in, this family you find yourself in, this job you have been given, the weather conditions that prevail this very moment. We must learn to find the goodness of God, you guys, in our actual life. Not tomorrow, but today. Not when X, Y, and Z happens, but right here and now. Not in a fantasy, but in reality. Many of you are familiar with the famous line from the Serenity Prayer. You know what I'm talking about? Here's the way most people know it today. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. That prayer was written by Reinhold Niebuhr. I think that's how you pronounce that. If I was German, I'm sure there would be a little more in there. But he was an American, Reformed theologian. He was an ethicist, a commentator on politics and public affairs, and professor at Union Theological Seminary for over 30 years. He wrote and spoke frequently about the intersection of religion, politics, and public policy. Time magazine named him the greatest Protestant theologian in America in his day. Now, these days, he's mostly just known for the Serenity Prayer. But in his day, he was known for a lot more than that. But in doing some research, I just found this interesting. Niebuhr wrote this, the Serenity Prayer, in 1932. It's been around since 1932. Does anybody know what was happening in America in the early 1930s? Great Depression. It was the Great Depression, 3 years after the stock market crash of 1929. People were reeling. They were reeling from loss. They were reeling from hardship, from fear, from uncertainty. And this is the context in which Niebuhr wrote the Serenity Prayer. Now, these days, the prayer is known by most in like this really simplified form, but there's actually quite a bit more to it. I didn't know that until this week. I came across this. In its entirety, you guys, I think it's beautiful and it's powerful, and I think it's incredibly relevant to our context today. So to close the message, I want to invite Matt and Jen to kind of make their way back up. But I invite you guys, the rest of you, to just close your eyes and let me speak this over you. This prayer that has lasted almost a century in popular culture, it's still put on plaques everywhere you go. Just close your eyes and let these words wash over you. God, give me grace to accept with serenity the things that cannot be changed. Courage to change the things which should be changed, and the wisdom to distinguish the one from the other. Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as a pathway to peace, taking, as Jesus did, this sinful world as it is, not as I would have it, trusting that you will make all things right if I surrender to your will, so that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with you forever in the next. Amen.